Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Liberty Talk Radio, America's libertarian voice and independent streaming internet radio station available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, from our studio in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to around the world. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano, and this is your antidote to popular talk radio. This broadcast is being brought to you live on Wednesday evening, January 12th, 2011, is now 7:01 p.m. Central Time. Folks, it's time for us to take back control of our government now before this bureaucratic, oversized, and self-serving federal government starves us of our property, our freedom, our rights, and our liberty. To do this, we must shed conventional thinking regarding our political structure. We need to be revolutionaries in thought, dissidents in action. Only after we recognize what our government is doing to our freedom and our Constitution will we start taking it back. And this program is just about that. Well, good evening, everyone. During our live broadcast, we invite you to call toll-free 888-773-4496. That's 888-773-4496. Of course, you can send us your comments to us anytime to comments@libertytalkradio.com. Ladies and gentlemen, this evening, it's our pleasure to have Jim Mascara, author of Escaping Oz, as our guest. In his book, Jim discovers the financial crisis and steps individuals should take. He also operates an economic and financial website, thesentinel.biz. Please join us by calling with your comments toll-free, 888-773-4496. Our phone lines are now open, and Jim is on the air.
Good evening, Joe.
Good evening, Jim. Thank you so much for being our guest this evening.
Nice. Thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. Jim, I read the briefings of your book. I did not have an opportunity to read your book, but it sounds tantalizing. And I have some questions, but I do want to give you the opportunity just to open up and give us an idea of who do we have as a guest this evening?
My name is Jim Mascara. My day job, the thing that pays the bills, is actually in the telecommunications industry. My background is in industrial engineering. I have a bachelor's and a master's in that. About 20 or so more years ago, I began, a more in-depth study about the commodity markets, the stock market, the bond market, and so forth. I started trading commodities in 1987. And actually was fortunate, and believe it or not, I can say fortunate, that I started trading during the stock market crash of 1987 because there were some opportunities there to make some money, and I was fortunate enough to be able to do that. Over the course of time, I acquired a Series 3 license, where a commodity trading advisor, and again, continued to trade commodities. And in the late 1990s, I began to sense, based on the industry that I was in, which was very close to the internet technology boom, I began to notice kind of a sense that there were a lot of people that were kind of willy-nilly investing and really didn't have a cogent plan for, you know, what they were doing in the market, when they were going to exit the market, and so forth. So through informal conversations that I had with people, and again, being in the industry that I was in, which was in the technology and internet industry, I sensed that there was a bubble brewing. And so one of the things I did was I tried to advise close friends and family members to try to exit the stock market at that point in time. And, of course, we know what happened in the year 2000. As the years 2000, the decade of 2000 proceeded, right around the time of 2006 or so, I began to get that same sense again. And in the summer of 2007, I made a call, I guess, if you will, internally to a closer group of friends that I thought that we were approaching another stock market top.
Okay.
Shortly after that time, I began the financial newsletter that you mentioned, the Sentinel Financial Report. And then within the course of the last year, I started thinking more about writing a book called Escaping Oz, which uses the metaphor of the Wizard of Oz to kind of describe our journey into the financial quagmire we have today.
Very good. That's fascinating. It seems as if the business that you were in, your day job, so to speak, is totally divorced from what you actually wind up doing and writing a book on, which I find fascinating. When you said you had a sense of a bubble, can you describe that more tangibly for us?
Yeah, one of the things, Joe, I write about in the book is I came up with some investment and economic laws. My investment law number one basically says have a plan for making profits. And investment law number two says have a plan for taking losses. I really felt in the late 1990s, around 2000, that people really didn't have a plan for taking a profit. So as an example, I had friends of mine that, again, we're in the technology business. They invested in our technology stocks. And yet, rationally, when you looked at, you know, what the price earnings multiples were on some of these stocks, some of the dividend yields associated with them, you really had to take a great leap of faith that even despite some of the lagging earnings that these companies had, and of course some of them had no earnings, that you were really betting a lot that you were going to continue to see capital gains. And so some of my friends were sitting on some capital gains, and I would just ask them the question, well, what would make you exit this stock or this particular investment?
Right.
And really nobody had an answer for that. And so that led me to believe that there was a lot of speculation going on in the market based on, you know, just common investors. And usually common investors, you know, the public, the general public is generally the last to pile into an investment mania. And so right around the time that you see that is a sign of a top.
Right. Yeah. Now, are we at a bubble again? Are we at a mini bubble right now with the stock market because of the government infusion of all of the funds that have gone into the, well, what do you call it, the stimulus funds, or the trillions that have gone to our banksters and whatever? Has that filtered into the stock market, or is that just loose rhetoric?
No, it absolutely has, and one of the themes of the book is to really look at how credit flows affect, you know, investment, and obviously, you know, your website, you know, the premise of your show is built on libertarian principles, and even though I don't get into necessarily libertarian principles per se, I do argue that, you know, when you have a lot of government intervention, in this case indirectly via credit creation in the marketplace, you tend to create distortions and misallocations of capital.
Right.
When that happens, it inevitably leads to bubbles, and there have been some very, very famous bubbles in history, you know, going back to the tulip bubble.
Right.
There was a South Sea bubble, and these are going back to the 1700s and 1800s. The problem now is that you have a bubble of just unimaginable proportions compared to anything in our history. So we experienced the first stage of the bubble pop in the 2007-2008 timeframe. We're seeing a reignition, if you will, of that bubble via, as you mentioned, some of the action with respect to additional credit creation and trying to continue to fuel the credit expansion, and some of it is psychologically driven by individual investors. But yeah, we're certainly trying to reignite that. Unfortunately, the consequences for the next bubble pop will be a little bit more severe.
Right. Well, let me ask you the quintessential common question that's always asked, and that is, whose fault was this financial debacle of 2008?
That's a great question. And, you know, one of the things I talk about is that to really assign the fault, if you will, singularly to one particular entity, I think is kind of a wrong approach. You know, there are many people and entities that participate in that. There are some books now. I think there was one that I saw not too long ago that, you know, they demonize Wall Street. You know, Wall Street's responsible for this.
Right.
And I guess, Joe, my answer to that would be there are many, many culprits. And really, the general public has to bear some responsibility as well, because in a credit transaction, there has to be a lender and a borrower. Well,
right.
The public at large obviously assumed a large credit acquisition role over the course of the last, you know, 10, 12, even further than that, 20 years. So I think there are many, many people complicit in eventually what happened.
Right. Well, I would assume that had it not been for government intervention, the ball would not have rolled downhill, and we would not have had the banks doing what they did. We wouldn't have the ultimate consumer doing what they did and down the line. Is that true, or is that just wishful thinking on my part?
I mean, that's absolutely right. I mean, government provides is a catalyst, so they provide the fuel for some of that to occur. And the vehicles for that, let's just use the housing market as an example, or institutions like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, right? So when you have institutions like that that were created, and then with some of the political theories about wanting to increase home ownership, I mean, that was a very direct government political mandate, if you will, was to try to increase home ownership. And it wasn't just in this country. In the United Kingdom in the late 1980s, Margaret Thatcher wanted the same thing. They wanted to increase the home ownership percentage in that country by a significant amount. There's ways to do that. The problem is that when you do that and you create, misallocations of capital via easy credit, then you run into situations that create bubbles in markets. And probably our quintessential bubble certainly is the housing market, which is nowhere near through deflating.
Yeah. Well, you know, my progressive friends really get on my case because I constantly attribute every problem we have ultimately to some sort of government intervention. And they just cannot see that. And I can see it very clearly, but maybe I'm the one that's blind. Jim, you had mentioned in your briefings that investors and business leaders, government officials and investment advisors were blindsided by this collapse. Why do you think that was so? I mean, why didn't these guys are no dummies. You know, I consider myself a dummy, but these guys have to be awfully smart for having the positions that they have. How could so many people have been blindsided?
Well, you know, Joe, that's the thing that happens when you're in a bubble. Oftentimes when you're in a bubble, it's difficult to really see that you're in the bubble. And there's a certain amount of arrogance, if you will, on the part of people like the Federal Reserve Bank, you know, government officials, that once you have a credit bubble going, that it's going to pop. I mean, no one wants to say the credit bubble is going to pop. And when our credit bubble obviously survived the year 2000 and the Internet stock boom and then its subsequent crash. Well, what happened after that? We made a bottom in the stock market in 2002, and we kept going from there. And of course, the housing market didn't reach its top until 2005, 2006. So when you're in the middle of the bubble, it's difficult. And let's say for the general public, very, very difficult for them to see. You know, you have to really take a retrospective look or step away for a minute, which is one of the things I tried to do. Try to be objective about what we're doing. I'll just give you an example. You know, when I saw real estate prices in certain states, just by comparing, and I live in St. Louis, so I would compare what a house in St. Louis would cost, again, roughly the same size, same square footage, and so forth, and I would compare it to, say, what was going on in Florida, California, where I had some friends, Las Vegas and so forth, Phoenix, where I had some friends as well. It just didn't make sense to me that the housing price in those cities should be that much more a multiple of what it was in St. Louis. Right. I mean, we're talking very similar housing in terms of materials and so forth. Right. So you really, really have to understand that how bubbles form when you're in it. It's very difficult to see that you're in it. And then there's a certain amount of hubris on the part of the people that have orchestrated the bubble, or I should say have assisted in its orchestration, government, Federal Reserve, and so forth, the banking industry, to admit that it won't pop.
Yeah. What do you think was the impetus for the government to encourage people to be homeowners regardless of the consequences? I mean, what was the logic behind that?
Well, you know, I thought about that as well, and one conclusion that I've come to is that it must be a very, very nice job with nice perks to be a representative or a senator in the United States Congress. Everybody wants to get elected. I mean, how many people, Joe, do you see that get elected is either a representative or a senator that then don't want to run again, right? It's rare.
That's right.
And that's one of the reasons why incumbents have, you know, such a strong reelection rate. It's about votes, right? I mean, if I want to get elected and I say that the government can do this for you, and we can create these institutions and this infrastructure to facilitate you, your credit expansion via home ownership, it's going to look good. And again, it's difficult to see what's going on. And when you look at how much government has expanded, you know, over the course, and I use an example in the book, over the course of the last 100 years, comparing 1910 to 2010.
Right.
I mean, it is amazing how much bigger government is now. So the flip side of that is that then the people, the public, the electorate become very, very accustomed to having these benefits provided to them by government. Whether it's a direct transfer payment, you know, Social Security, unemployment, so forth, or through the facilitation of credit like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
You know, it really concerns me right now, Jim, that if someone stubs their toe in Mozambique, the U.S. government has to get involved and find out why they stubbed their toe and maybe send an entourage there to maybe fix the problem. You understand me? No matter what it is around the world, you know, we have to be there to solve the problem. Anything that happens here domestically, the government has to be there to solve the problem or be part of the solution or purportedly part of the solution. And there seems to be a growing belief that this is the way government should run. What's your take on that?
Well, another theme discussed in the book, you know, there's some sociological, if you will, themes as well in the book besides just some of the hard, you know, financial numbers. But I think that the United States has kind of gone away from being a republic and certainly gone to being more of an empire. Well,
right.
It takes a lot of money and manpower to manage an empire. And, you know, when your fiscal condition at home is not really good, we know what sort of budget deficits we run yearly and what our national debt is, funded debt, not even including the unfunded debt of Social Security and Medicare, it really becomes difficult to then continue to manage that empire. And,
right.
You know, one of my contentions in the book is that over the course of time, you will see a retrenchment of what we do as a country, you know, overseas and certainly, you know, on a domestic level, because we just simply won't have the money to do it.
Right. Well, just the other day, I heard that I think we gave either $100 million or $300 million to, I think, Yemen as some additional aid. And I often think to myself, where did that come from? You know, we're broke and we're giving someone hundreds of millions of dollars, you know?
Because it's not like we had an extra 100 or 300 million sitting in our back pocket.
Right. And you would think that we had no problems in Detroit, you know, or any other, you know, old city or northern city in the United States, and that they're all fine and running smoothly and up to date and their transportation is fine. You know, everything is fine. And we had all this extra money. Don't know what to do with it. Let's give it to Yemen, you know. Anyway, hold on a second.
Well, Joe, I was being interviewed on a show yesterday by a Texas credit union. And, you know, one of the things I pointed out to them was, can you imagine if the following question had been posed to Americans post 9/11? Okay, we've been attacked, and we think that the attackers are in Afghanistan. We're going to go into Afghanistan, and we're going to try to find the perpetrators of the crime. And again, there's obviously some issues with that statement, but we're going to go find the perpetrators. And in order to do that, we have to apply a tax to every household of X. And, you know, it's going to be a progressive tax, so the more you make, the more you're going to pay. And then, by the way, we want to also go and invade Iraq, and we're going to have to pay for that, so we're going to have to assess your household the tax of X again, which is also progressive. So if we really looked at, and I discuss this in the book, if we really looked at how we spend money and what we spend money for, we might take a little bit different view on how that money is spent. But the problem is that we really, as a nation or as an individual household, we haven't really felt the direct effect of, you know, our overseas adventures, you know, whether they're military action, aid, and so forth, because it really never comes back to a tax on the individual.
Right.
We've been financing that for a long period of time. And, you know, we're going to have a debate here very soon about whether Congress should raise the debt ceiling again beyond the $14 trillion. So there is right now. I mean, you see some intersection of politics and economics. I talk about the Tea Party briefly in the book, just from the standpoint of there's going to be a torrent, if you will, of public anger that's going to arise as a result of, again, this intersection of politics and economics. And I just think it'll be very, very difficult for the country to continue to do some of the things that it does.
Right. And remind me, I want to comment on that right after a very quick station identification, Jim. Just hold on there for
it. Political talk derived from a historical perspective. Not always palatable, but good food for thought. Pure Libertarian Talk with host Joe Cristiano, LibertyTalkRadio.com.
Folks, this is Joe Cristiano. You're listening to Liberty Talk Radio. We are so pleased to have as our guest Jim Mascari. He's the author of Escaping Oz. Jim discusses the financial crisis and steps individuals should take. He also operates the economic and financial website, thesentinel.biz. Please join us by calling toll-free 888-773-4496. That 888-773-4496. We really welcome your calls and comments, questions, criticism. We take them all, okay, with respect. Thank you. You know, Jim, I remember when I was a child, and now you'll know exactly about how old I am. I went into a candy store on First Avenue in East Harlem, where I grew up. And I wanted to buy, and I don't recall what it was, but it was a very, very small sort of penny toy, if you will, or nickel toy. And I picked it up, and it was made out of plastic, I believe, and I couldn't figure it out. And I asked the store owner, who, by the way, was very nasty to everybody. You know, it was the old candy store type place, but he was a very nasty guy. And I said, yeah, I want the metal one. He said, you don't get the metal one. Don't you know we're at war? And he was referring to the Korean War. In other words, there was some physical manifestation that we were at war. There were certain things that were very difficult to get. Now, obviously, during World War II, we had victory gardens. You could not buy a new car, et cetera, et cetera. Today, when we initiated the war with Iraq, that was supposed to solve all of our problems, what did George Bush say? Go shopping. And, you know, you're right, it's got to come from someplace. What's your take on that?
Well, you know, government has, you know, and this really started a long time ago. When government has to fight a war, you know, everybody needs to remember, you know, what do you need to do? Unless the war is in your backyard, you've got to mobilize troops, you've got to send them somewhere.
Right.
So there's all the logistics associated with that. You've got to feed them, you've got to clothe them. Oh, and by the way, you still have to pay them a salary. You know, using up ammunition. War is a costly effort. But, you know, going back to the time of the Revolutionary War, the fledgling government in the United States issued a special currency that they called the Continental because
right.
they didn't have enough money to pay their troops. They didn't want to start taxing the colonists even more because, of course, you know, there was the initial issue with Great Britain about taxation, which certainly was a catalyst in precipitating the Revolutionary War in the first place. So they didn't feel that was a palatable option. So what they did instead was they created something called a Continental. So they paid people that were dealing with the government in these Continentals. Well, the problem was that Continental didn't have any value. I mean, it was a piece of paper that said it was redeemable for a Spanish mill dollar, and it was which in turn was redeemable for gold, silver, and so forth. So when they started creating these Continentals, it created this instant inflation with that currency. And as a result of that, by the time the war ended, there came this expression that said it wasn't worth a Continental. So the Continental had been devalued significantly. Well, we don't have a Continental today, but the only thing the government does that's analogous to that is, well, it borrows money. And it can borrow money from, you know, people like you and me through pension funds, hedge funds, overseas investors, more recently here, the Federal Reserve Bank, which, of course, is the creation of money artificially. So there are more, I guess, covert ways, if you will, of fighting wars now and spending money that don't involve the creation of piece of paper that then get handed out directly to the people.
Right. Well, it seems strange that they're printing all of this money. They are placing the war expense off the balance sheet items. I wish I could do that with my business. You would think, logically, that we would be experiencing massive inflation. And now we seem to be experiencing inflation in the commodities arena, you know, wheat, corn, and whatever. That's where I have some of my money, obviously. But we've been spending this money now for years. And yet the CPI becomes tamer and tamer. I don't understand that.
I am so glad you brought up that point. Another very salient point that I talk about in the book, and that's a concept called deflation. Deflation is a concept that is very, very difficult for a lot of people to understand because most people haven't experienced it. The last sustained period of price decline in this country was during the Great Depression, so during the 1930s. So most people alive today would not have experienced that. Deflation is difficult to understand because, by definition, deflation is a reduction in the amount of outstanding money and credit. Well,
correct.
When you see price declines, that is an effect of a deflationary condition. So if you have an economy with a fixed amount of goods, and then all of a sudden you create a lot of money and or credit in that process, well, each one of those dollars then is worth less relative to the goods that they're chasing.
Right.
Well, the converse of that means that the amount of credit and money in an economy, let's say it contracts, so it shrinks, that's a deflationary process. So that means that each dollar that's still available in the economy is worth actually a little bit more.
Right.
So to your point, the Federal Reserve and government has gone on this just remarkable, incredible spending binge over the course of the last few years. And by definition, many people should have concluded, well, we should be in a massive hyperinflation, and yet we're not.
Right.
And part of the reason for that is because one of the reasons, probably the main reason, particularly the Federal Reserve did what they did, is because Ben Bernanke, a student of the Great Depression, he understands what deflation is. He won't talk about it publicly, although I did hear him say that in a 60 Minutes interview last month. He actually did mention the word deflation, which is very unusual. He's deathly afraid of deflation. And so everything that's been done to this point has kind of balanced out the amount of money and credit in the economy to some degree. If you look at money and credit in the economy overall through a figure that's called M3, it's actually shrunk since 2008. And so that should tell you that there's less money and credit in the economy, which means there's less of that to chase goods and services. Now, it'll show up more pronounced in some areas than others. Where we've seen it in our economy more from a deflationary perspective has been the housing market. Right. It will hit other areas as well. It hit the stock market to some degree, and it'll hit that stock market again. So deflation is a very difficult concept to understand, but it is something by the end of this economic cycle, people will know what it is.
All right, but aren't we, in fact, creating more money to support the war in Afghanistan, Iraq, you know, our empire, so to speak, and including all of the stimulus money? Aren't we creating more money? But I have heard that that the M3 money supply is actually decreasing, which I don't understand.
Yeah, we are. I mean, everything that we're doing as a government, as the Federal Reserve, they're trying to keep the money supply. When you're in a credit-based economy, especially the economy that we're based on, you have to continue to create credit in order to fuel the monster. Well,
right.
When credit starts to contract, and so let's talk a little bit about what contracts credit. Well, if I'm a bank and I have a loan, let's say for residential real estate or commercial real estate, and there's a problem with that loan and that loan defaults, well, all of a sudden, that amount of money, which again was credit, electronic entry in the banking system, when that goes away, now all of a sudden there's less credit, if you will, in the banking system,
right.
Which means there's less credit in the economy, which means that there's X number of dollars less to chase goods and services in the economy. And we'll just use housing as an example.
All right, great.
Housing is probably the quintessential example of that right now.
Okay, but didn't they create money or monetize more debt in order to support the empire as well as all the other programs, the social programs and the quantitative easing, if you will? Did that not counterbalance
that? Yeah, that's exactly
what
quantitative easing intends to do. Is the Federal Reserve, through the magic of their own credit creation, will go into the market and buy treasury bonds. They also have authority to buy other things to, as they put it, stabilize the monetary system. So they have done those things. And if you look at a chart of the Federal Reserve, it's something called an adjusted monetary base, you'll see it spike up like a rocket
right.
in 2008.
Right.
But at the same time, when you look at, I think you cited the figure we talked about earlier, M3, which is kind of a broader base view of all of the money and credit in the economy, that's actually shrunk. So what that tells you is that had the Federal Reserve and the government not done what they did, that amount in M3 would have shrunk even more, and we would be experiencing more deflation right now than we have already.
Okay.
The problem is that there's only a certain amount that the Federal Reserve can do to continue to forestall those deflationary effects. And moreover, if you look at what the Federal Reserve did in 2008, from the average person, Joe Q. Public, he's only seen that unemployment got worse. The job market's not stable. The economy's shaky right now, maybe showing a little bit of growth. And so they have to ask themselves the question, well, what have we gotten for all that? You know, what has the stock market done?
Right.
Now we're talking about going into another round of quantitative easing. And if quantitative easing round number one was so successful, why do we need quantitative easing round number two? Well, the reason is because our Fed chairman, the Federal Reserve, is deathly afraid of more deflation. They're not concerned about inflation right now.
Okay, all right. Now, there's an organization, the National Inflation Association, the NIA. Are you familiar with them?
I am not, sir.
Okay, well, they put out a broadcast almost every day or every week and talking about the upcoming hyperinflation. Would you subscribe to that, or are you saying we stand more of a chance of deflation than inflation in the future?
Yeah, I don't see any hyperinflation. And again, if you look at what's just been done, so if you're just looking at it from a monetary perspective, look at what the Federal Reserve did starting in 2008. And again, there's a chart. You can do the research. It's called adjusted monetary base.
Right.
You can see what the level is for many, many years. Then when 2008, when the financial crisis hit, it literally spikes up like a rocket. It goes completely vertical. And by in theory, that the injection of all that money into the banking system, again, you would think would have created a significant amount of hyperinflation.
Right.
On top of that, you've been running government deficits in the $1+ trillion range now for the last, I guess, 3 years or so, maybe four fiscal years, and you still don't see it. So that should tell the hyperinflationists that something is amiss with that theory that, okay, if I just create all this money, that I will immediately have hyperinflation.
Correct.
Well, the problem with credit is, I should say a problem, the issue with credit is that it takes two to do that dance. If I'm a banker and I want to make a loan to you, so I want to provide you, Joe, a credit line, and I say, Joe, I got this great credit line for you. The interest rate's real low. Please borrow. Well, you can say, you know what? I've been burned here with credit lately. My job is kind of shaky. My finances are a little shaky. I don't know that I want to borrow any money. So even though there could be a whole lot of credit made available, unless the borrowing side of that equation wants to participate, credit will not be created, and it will not come into the economy.
Okay. Do you see that? Do you see that money being created? You see credit opening up again, or you think we're going to be in this sort of malaise, similar to what Japan has been in as well, for a long period of time?
Yeah, there's some cyclical influences here as well, and one of the topics in the book is the study of cycles, and there's different waves and cycles that come into play, and these waves are predicated on human psychology. So when you have favorable public psychology, as you did, let's say, during the credit boom years of the 1990s and early 2000s, people will want to borrow, people will want to spend money. When that psychology changes, again, for a variety of reasons, then you may not have that same interest in continuing to borrow money. Right now, as an example, if you are a homeowner, and let's say you're underwater on your loan, and your loan is coming up for refinance, and let's say you're significantly underwater, let's say, I'll say 20 to 25%.
Okay.
How eager will you be to refinance that loan, probably at a higher interest rate, and then refinance that loan for more than your house is worth?
Right.
On the other side of the equation, how eager is a bank going to be to help you refinance? So in the housing market in particular, which is a large part, obviously, of the credit in this economy, we're in somewhat of a lockdown mode with respect to all the credits that's been issued and the value of all that collateral. So Japan has, again, tried to forestall a lot of their deflation through a whole lot of government action, and yet they've been in a deflationary spiral for a decade or more.
Right.
A similar fate awaits us. There's just simply no way to liquidate all of this credit, you know, without default or without prices. I mean, the market can take care of all this from the standpoint of, you know, letting the market action take hold, which the rectification for all this eventually, and it will be a very, very painful process, will be, you know, large waves of default or price declines that will then balance out, you know, the amount of credit and then demand for credit.
Well, how do you square that, reconcile that with the price of gold being about $1,375 an ounce and the price of oil being, I think today it closed at over $92 a barrel? Aren't those products of inflationary pressures or debasement of the dollar, however you want to look at it?
The oil market made a high in 2008, I believe, and it was right around $150 a barrel.
Right.
That was a market, and from my perspective as a commodity trader, that was clearly in a very significant degree of speculation.
Right.
That basically topped off in what we call kind of like a blow-off top. I mean, it
right.
went and made $150 a barrel. There was discussion of, you know, $5 a gallon gas
right.
in the United States, and
right.
of course all of the ramifications that come with that. The price of oil then just plummeted, right, probably to, what, 50% of its high, somewhere right. in the mid-70s,
exactly.
maybe $80
right.
a barrel. Now it's come back up to $90 a barrel. From a technician's point of view, this does not look like a new bull market in oil. On the gold side, gold is an interesting commodity because it is a commodity. It has some industrial applications. But gold is the ultimate wealth representation because it has a history of being wealth. My personal opinion right now is that gold is in a not a pronounced bubble, but a bubble of sorts where you you see the public trying to embrace gold a little bit more. Again, I'm not trying to compare it to some of the other bubbles that we've had, but one of the barometers I use for that are the number of commercials that appear right now on TV asking to buy your gold.
Right, exactly.
At some point, the price of gold, if it hasn't already, will top, and it will recede from where it is right now. My projection is that is probably stage one. The second stage of that at some point in the future will be a recognition that all of the money that we have, the Federal Reserve notes in this country, you take any other country for that matter, that money isn't really honest money, so we need something else to back it. Whether that ends up being gold or not is a matter of some speculation, but if you think about the history of gold, especially as a store of value and wealth and a representation of money, it probably stands to reason that the honest money in the future may be backed by gold.
Okay, let's pause for station identification one more time.
Political talk derived from a historical perspective, not always palatable, but good food for thought. Pure Libertarian Talk with host Joe Cristiano. LibertyTalkRadio.com.
This evening we have Jim Mosquera with us. He's the author of Escaping Oz. Jim discusses the financial crisis and steps individuals should take. He also operates the economic and financial website, thesentinel.biz. We'd like you to join this conversation by calling toll-free, 888-773-4496. Now, folks, we know you're out there. Please give us a call. That's 888-773-4496. Jim, we have someone else on the wire. Let's take a call. Caller, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
My name is Erin.
Yeah. Hi, Erin.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hello.
Hello.
Okay. I have a question that was instigated by a story on National Public Radio earlier this week, and I didn't hear the entire program, and so I'm a little sketchy, but they were talking about utilizing something, to my mind, ethereal in calculating a country's gross national product and in order to compare countries. And they were saying that we should include happiness as a product. Is that something that it was just a figment of my imagination? Or is that really something that's being discussed by logical people in this country?
I didn't personally hear the story, but you know, one of the things that happens with a gross domestic product is it is a function, oftentimes, of some of the credit that's associated with what's being spent in the economy. So, if you create a lot of credit, and then all of a sudden your GDP goes up, it looks good on paper because the government can say, okay, we're a more productive country now than we were before. However, it doesn't take a look at the other side of it, which, okay, well, how much debt did it take to create that? The fact that there's some discussion about trying to inject other components that are not, let's just say, far less tangible than, the products of goods and services sold in this country, kind of makes you wonder, you know, who had that idea and probably some lack of confidence that maybe they want to include some other things in GDP to create a more healthy appearance for our economy.
Hmm. Well, I just wondered if that was just sort of a flight of fancy that I just happened to hear about, or if it was.
I wonder how they would measure
that. Government official?
No, it was a discussion on National Public Radio, maybe. Monday of this week.
Who was advocating that position?
You know, I don't know. like I said, I didn't get the beginning of the program, but it was probably on their archives, and I do need to look it up because it has, I've thought about it since then. I really have kind of thought about the oddity of using things that are not what I would consider products.
Right.
But I guess the reason that they are wanting to utilize something like that is that it would be something that, in a way, is sellable, if it can be shown that people in our country are happier in general than people in other countries or some other individual country. And maybe that would lead to greater tourism, et cetera.
Yeah,
anyway,
I mean, that was
just my weird question.
Yeah, that's an interesting approach. I know that there are indices that are developed by worldwide organizations that measure things like that, like, you know, the health of a country and so forth, and their happiness index, if you will.
Yeah.
But to tie that into the GDP, I haven't heard of that before.
Well, thank you very much. I'm sorry to interrupt, but since you were talking about economics, I thought maybe I could get my question. Thank you.
You
so
didn't
much.
Interrupt, Aaron. Call anytime. Thank you so much for calling. Good night. Oh, that's great. I love that. Oh, and here we go. We have another. You want to take another caller? Jim?
Sure.
Okay, here we go. Caller, you're on the air. Your first name, where you're calling from, please.
Okay, that must be me, huh?
Hello. Hello. We can hear you, but you're humming.
Is that me?
Yes, it's you, but you're humming.
Well, my phone likes to hum a lot.
Okay.
My name is Joe.
You're Joe, and I'll bet you're
from... sorry for the buzz.
Okay. Joe, how are you?
I'm doing all right. Happy New Year, Joe. The thing is that I just got here. I don't know what your guest is about. I just wanted to find out when you're coming on the air again, because I'd like to be able to talk to you about some certain libertarian subjects.
Okay. Oh, you're talking to me now. Not our guest,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, to you. I'm not talking to your guest.
Yeah, when I rant on Thursday morning at 6:30 in the morning, and when I have a guest, it's Wednesday evening at 7 p.m., and that's both Central Time.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a little too early for me.
All right. Have you been listening to the program,
right,
and do you have any questions for our guest?
No, sure don't. What I'll do, I'll just get off the air now, and I'll catch you when I catch you.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much for calling, Joe.
Okay.
Bye. Yeah.
Okay. Take care, Joe.
All right, thank
Bye-bye.
You. Bye. There are many people who have been investing in gold for 10, 20 years, and many they've done very well. Their take on it is that the dollar is doomed, that it will not survive. No dollar, no currency has survived an empire. We are spending money foolishly. We have too many government programs. You know, the list goes on and on and on, and you can't argue with any of that. Why would not a person want to buy, and it doesn't have to be gold, it could be any commodities, stay in commodities, even in light of the fact that we may be in a slight deflationary environment?
Okay, 2 points. Keep in mind that commodities respond to credit conditions as well, and all our commodities are priced in what?
Dollars, yeah,
right?
Right.
And so the dollar, again, that is chasing those commodities are products of the creation of credit that exists within the economy. And again, much of the credit in the entire world, as a matter of fact, is denominated in dollars. When there is a reduction in those amount of dollars that represent the credit in the economy, the remaining dollars become more valuable. One of the things I talk about in the book is that during a deflation, cash is king. However, gold is a very, very important, is a unique commodity because it has always represented money. And so I advocate in the book that everyone should own some gold regardless of the price. Now,
okay.
The flip side of that is, well, should I pile into a bunch of gold right now? My contention would be the price of gold will be lower in the future. So if you want to buy more gold, which I think people should in the future, it will take fewer dollars to do that. Now, to denigrate the dollar compared to any other currency that exists in the world, I don't think it is totally accurate for this reason. and this reason only, there is no other currency in the world of which I'm aware that represents anything other than an obligation to pay a debt. You know, we got rid of that convertibility many, many years ago, and there was an agreement after World War II called Bretton Woods,
right,
which tied other currencies to the dollar.
Right.
And the dollar at that point in time was convertible in these other currencies to foreign governments into gold. President Richard Nixon closed that window in 1971.
Right.
So since that point in time, a dollar has basically represented, in fact, if you look at the Federal Reserve note, it doesn't say that it's worth anything. It just says that this note is legal tender for all
right.
debts, public and private. And even the Federal Reserve and the government really have a hard time defining what a dollar truly is. So if the dollar is doomed as a currency, which I think eventually it will have its problems as well, you can make that same argument for any other paper currency. And so that's one of the reasons I think that over the course of time, when these currencies do fail, and again, not just the dollar, but any other paper-based currency, there's going to be some initiative, I think, on the part of the electorate to have something stand behind it. And that thing that can stand behind it is gold. It has worked before, and there's no reason to think it won't work again.
Well, isn't that the concern that most people have, is that the dollar is becoming worthless regardless of inflation or deflation, that the government is trying to maintain an empire, maintain a social network which is unsustainable, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So eventually the dollar is doomed, and many countries are now trying to trade with each other outside of the world's reserve currency, Russia, China, and there's several other examples.
That is absolutely true. But again, look at it from the standpoint of when credit starts to contract, and so all of the debt that's out there primarily denominated in dollars, when there's fewer of those dollars available, and again, just think about it in terms of denominated in dollars, that the remaining dollars become more valuable. And if you're thinking, let's take it to one more step in the process, in the credit process. Let's say there's less credit available, period, so you can't go to your bank or your credit union
right.
and borrow like you did before. Cash, and by cash I literally mean the Federal Reserve notes that people
right.
have in their wallets and purses,
right.
that becomes a lot more valuable. And so it would be more difficult to conduct transactions economically, in our economy and other economies, with people walking around with pieces of gold and transacting in that manner.
Right.
The currencies that we have, the paper currencies, will continue to have value until such point that then people lose absolute confidence in them. And again, I want to emphasize, Joe, that I'm not just talking about the U.S. dollar, but any paper
right.
currency. And again, to my knowledge, there's no currencies out there that are backed by anything.
Well, I guess the argument for that would be, and this is an assumption on my part, Jim, is that if we get to that point where people actually don't have as many dollars in their pocket, so they're not spending. The job market is still, assuming the job market is still is in the malaise that it's in right now, that the government will feel compelled to do something and in effect start printing a hell of a lot more money and put us back to where we were in 2008. And that's what people
Great
say.
Point.
They say, hold on to your,
that,
hold on to your gold and buy as much as you can, because the government will not permit deflation, they will print themselves to oblivion.
So that's an argument that the inflationists like to use, and it's a valid argument to this point.
Yeah.
I talked earlier about how during the Revolutionary War, the government did print. I mean, when we talk about let's clarify one thing. When we say that the government is printing money, we're not really talking literally about the printing of Federal Reserve notes and the distribution of those. We're talking about the facilitation of credit. So in other
right.
words, credit being
That's
available
correct.
To lend into the economy, which, as we talked about earlier, just because it's available doesn't mean it comes into the economy. Somebody's got to want to borrow it.
Okay.
The only thing that could derail the deflation argument would be the government literally going to the printing press and printing out Federal Reserve notes, okay, and that process then taking those dollars and injecting them directly into the economy, a la like what they've done in Zimbabwe and so forth.
Right.
Well, when you look at the number of dollars, Federal Reserve notes, paper bills, in existence relative to all of the credit that exists in the economy, the number of paper dollars is very, very small compared to that
Great.
Goal.
Right.
And so unless the government went on some massive, massive printing spree where they then started distributing these dollars and paying in those dollars, then having a and inflation like you saw in the Weimar Republic in Germany and you've seen in Zimbabwe really is very much more difficult to accomplish. You know, we live in a credit-based society, and I think that's one thing I want to get across to your listeners tonight, that, you know, creating credit and creating paper dollars is two very different things.
All right. Let me be, in the interest of full disclosure, I always have a difficulty understanding that. And not that I have difficulty understanding you. You're very concise and logical. My mind does not function very well when it comes to money and banking. And I've told the story a million times. I'm going to say it again. Is that when I was in college, I should have taken money and banking, and I decided to take some other class. And to this day, I regret not taking that course in money and banking because it's been haunting me ever since. And I really have difficulty with that. I guess we have the money being printed is being given to the bank at about a zero rate, interest rate. That money is not coming through. People are not borrowing, as you say. Jobs are not coming back. I mean, we can kiss that goodbye. All the statistics aside, we're just not coming. We're not going to be back to the World War II era anymore. Those days are gone. We're now an empire. We're hellaciously in debt. If interest rates go up, a good portion of our tax revenue goes to just satisfy the debt. I mean, at what point do we start increasing the money supply to pay off the debt and thus creating some sort of inflationary environment, I guess? And I can't seem to separate one from the other. And I'm sorry for the long dissertation, Jim.
No, that's fine. Well, here's the problem. If the government continues to grow at its present rate, it has to be funded from somewhere.
Correct.
Okay, so it's going to be funded by individuals, private domestic investors, foreign investors. In the absence of that investment, the Federal Reserve steps in, right, and they participate in this quantitative easing
right.
process. But
yeah.
when you do that, what are you doing? You're creating more debt, right? Our national funded debt right now is more than $14 trillion.
Correct.
We're going to add another $1.5 trillion to the deficit this year, so the debt ceiling is going to have to be raised even further. So.
Right.
To your point, if interest rates start to increase, which my forecast is that they will, particularly on the long-term side, you're going to have to spend more and more money to finance that debt. So at some point, you have to decide that you cannot continue to grow government like that because you won't have the funds to continue to pay off the debt. And again, this is we're having these discussions now at very historically low interest rates.
Right.
There's just no way for the government to get out of this problem right now without a reduction in what they do. Because until you have the point, when you reach the point, Joe, that and credit is confidence. That's one thing that I talk about in the book. Without credit, you don't have confidence. Without confidence, you don't have credit. So at the point where there are no more willing lenders to the government to finance this, and at the point where people decide that they don't want to hold U.S. government treasury bonds at the 30-year rate because a lot of it's being bought by the Federal Reserve with funny money that doesn't exist, you're going to demand higher and higher interest rates.
Right.
We've been very lucky to this point that interest rates have been as low as they have been. They're artificially low, particularly on the long-term end. If you get back to a point where interest rates reach a historical level or, you know, above that historical average, you've got a really, really serious problem on your hands.
You know, Jim, I'm a man of absolutely no faith at this point. I just don't see how we're going to get out of this mess. It seems like we keep on digging the hole deeper and deeper, and I personally I can't seem to hold on to any dollars. Any money I have gets invested somewhere in something tangible, whether or not it's an EFT in uranium, food, a futures, something. And maybe I'm just I'm foolish and I'm overreacting, but I just don't see us getting out of this thing. I just see it getting worse. Tea Party aside, what's your prognosis?
Let me add a point.
Yeah,
I think that the solution to a lot of these problems is to let the market take its course. The problem is I don't think our political leaders and really the general public, which is one of the really main reasons I even wrote the book, is that the general public needs to understand that the market has a solution for this, and it's called liquidation, default, bad debt, and those are all bad things. But in the end, you know, the market will correct itself. There will be all of the assets that exist in this country, you know, the buildings, the land, you know, the factories and so forth, they will still exist, absent some, calamitous event that occurs.
Absolutely.
All those
right.
things will still be here.
Yeah.
Now, they may be valued differently, and they may have different owners in the future, but they'll still be here. The problem is that everything that the Federal Reserve and the government has done to this point is trying to forestall that.
Right.
But we have never been at a point historically in our economic history that we have had this much credit inflation. And again, there comes a saturation point. And if you want to look at it another way, Joe, think about it. If it was your own household and everybody had been shoving credit at you, you were mortgaged to the hilt, and somebody keeps pushing credit your way. Well, at some point, you're going to say, you know what, uncle, I can't do this anymore.
Correct.
And you may have problems paying back, your loans. You may go into, strategic default. There's a lot of things that you can do. And then all of a sudden, the value of all that stuff that you have that's valued in dollars comes collapsing down.
Correct.
Because that's the process of liquidation and default and so forth. All that's deflationary. There's nothing inflationary about any of that.
Right. Well, my contention, and believe me, I do not know if I'm right, correct in this, is that the government will continue to kick this can down the road, as they say. And there will be a come to Jesus meeting somewhere down the road. It ain't going to be pretty.
I don't see any political will.
Right. No political will. That's the word for it. And it ain't going to be pretty. And when it happens, it ain't going to be deflationary. It's going to be some sort of demise of the dollar or a confidence loss of the dollar somehow. And I don't know how that plays out.
It just gets me very
nervous,
Yeah, think about it as a two-stage process. You have to have the deflation. So it's really a three-stage process. You can't have deflation until you've had inflation. So we've already had the inflation. We're starting to get into the deflationary process. At the end of that, deflation destroys everything. There'll be a loss of confidence.
Right.
And then there will be a renewal, if you will, for people to think about what represents their currency.
Right.
And again, what might represent that currency, if you want to still call it a dollar, if you want to still call it a euro, there has to be something tangible behind it that doesn't allow the credit to expand as readily. And there will be calls for, what the Federal Reserve's role needs to be and whether they need to exist at all. Representative Ron Paul has been calling for that, within the course of the last few years. So there will be a new era, if you will. But I just want to emphasize that, everything that exists in the United States today, the land, the factories,
all of the other productive capacity
will still continue to exist. It'll just be valued differently.
Right. It'll be valued in new dollars, if you will, and so will gold. But then that new dollar may be a 10-to-1 ratio or 4-to-1 ratio, which means that gold, in fact, has increased itself 4 to 10 times compared to its old currency. So if you have the currency, you're a loser. If you have the gold, you may at least break even. I'm assuming that to be the case. And that's the way I'm thinking.
The problem is, again, there's no political will right now, and unfortunately, it sometimes takes a calamitous event for people to have an awakening. I really hope, selfishly, obviously, I want to sell copies of my book, but the other side of it is I want people to educate themselves to understand, the structure of financial problems, and then they're responsible for electing our future leaders, right? And our president, our representative, our senators. And those are the people that you want to have, educated people that are running our government at the state and federal level that understand really what's going on. I don't know if I see that yet.
Right. Jim, we're about out of time. This has been one of the fastest hours we've had on this program. We certainly appreciate being our guest. Again, let me give you about 30 seconds to promote your book and your website, please.
Thank you. www.escapingoz.com. It can be purchased on Amazon. When you go to that page, escapingoz.com, I have a short excerpt from the book that you can read. There's a little bio. I also put a book trailer together that kind of talks about the book and some of the history behind it and some of the consequences, I guess, if we don't fix some of these economic problems.
Right.
It is a self-published book. And if you come to my website, www.thesentinel.biz, you can order it from there as well, and I can sign your copy of the book.
That's great, Jim. Thank you very much. And Jim, if you will send me an email with a mailing address and your T-shirt size, I'd love to send you a Liberty Talk Radio T-shirt.
I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much, Jim, for being our guest. Appreciate it very much. Good night.
All right. Good night.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. That was a very interesting conversation. Scary. This is the end of today's broadcast. We'd like to thank Ranch Acres Audiology for their financial support, and we'd like to thank you for listening in. Ranch Acres Audiology is a family hearing practice at 3227 East 31st Street in Tulsa. They may be reached at area code 918-749-7711. Call them for all your hearing needs. You'll be glad you did. Folks, you can further this cause of liberty by recommending this program to your friends, and let us hear from you. Our email address is comments@libertytalkradio.com. With that, until next time, I'm Joe Cristiano. This is Liberty Talk Radio. Stay well. Stay tuned.